Hello, Guitar Smarts listeners. This is an important announcement. Please don't skip ahead. We start this podcast with a special message. Way back in 2021, Guitar Smarts had the pleasure of interviewing the utterly fantastic Matt Long. Matt is a multiple award-winning British blues guitarist and lead singer of the British blues band Catfish and hard rock outfit The Revenant Ones. He joined us for episode number 20 and was a truly gracious guest who spoke about his career, his childhood, guitars, and meeting his hero, Joe Bonamassa. Well, Matt needs your help. Through 2023, Matt has been undergoing treatment for bowel cancer, and his recent prognosis has meant that to extend his life and retain a chance of survival, he needs to seek private treatment outside of the NHS. Matt's family have set up a GoFundMe page that is linked in the Guitar Smarts link tree in the description of this podcast, and we at the Guitar Smarts podcast would like to invite each and every listener to consider donating towards this fund that could well save the life of one of the brightest guitar talents of our generation. Now is the time, folks. Head on over to the link in the description to find the GoFundMe page. Donate what you can. Your donation could save a life. Thank you. Enjoy the podcast. Is it really just a linear scale between better and worse, cheaper and expensive? And I don't think it is. I think it's much more complex than that. It's not those two things aren't even necessarily linked. An expensive guitar can play extremely badly without the right attention to detail.
An
extremely cheap guitar can play beautifully and sound amazing just by chance that it's been put together in a really, really good way. And actually the cheap components that it has just sometimes happen to all work together perfectly. And you end up with something where you kind of just scratch your head and go, how is it possible for this instrument to feel and play this well? Greetings, welcome back to the Guitar Smarts podcast. Remember, if you're an everyday gigging guitarist, this is the podcast for you, and maybe your friends too, so please tell them about us. This week, Kieran and I discuss one of the oldest guitar-related questions ever. Do expensive guitars make you a better guitarist? Can a cheap guitar be as inspirational to play? Or does it all exist in our minds as a way of subconsciously compelling us to buy more guitars? Come and let us know what you think over on the Guitar Geek Hangout. We'd love to hear what you think. Housekeeping. Remember to like and subscribe to this podcast on your preferred podcast app. That way you'll never miss a show. There is a link tree in the description of this show where you can follow links to our Buy Me a Coffee page, links to some of our Spotify playlists, social media pages, especially the Guitar Geek Hangout page on Facebook, where you can interact with Kieran, myself, and many other guitar nerds just like us. If you really want to support us, use the links to leave us a rating or a review. This is the best way to support us, and it helps us to grow. And more importantly, it costs you nothing at all, but just a little bit of time. Have a great few weeks. Remember, if you've got any comments or requests or questions for the show, then you can reach out to us through our social media pages. That's about enough from me. Let's get to it. Dude, it's good to see you. It's been a few weeks, hasn't it, since we talked?
It has. We've had a couple of weeks break. We've been busy with work and life and all kinds of things. But that's good sometimes because it means we've got lots to catch up on, and it means we've got all this pent-up guitar stuff in our heads that we want to talk about. So, yeah, it's all good.
Absolutely, yeah. Lots of pent-up stuff. Actually, I've got to say I'm excited because tomorrow is my first gig of the year.
Hey.
Dep in for a great band down in Somerset. And it's going to be the first gig where I'm using the Catalyst.
So I'm really
looking forward to that, you know. I know it's going to work out great, but yeah, I can't wait to get that just in a gig situation, get it pumping. And I really like the set list for this band as well. There's a lot of classic kind of Motown stuff, a lot of kind of simple, a lot of easy stuff to enjoy still, and a lot of guitar fun stuff for me to kind of, you know, be selfish about. And this is good. And Mr. Brightside isn't in the set, so happy days.
That song's got, I never thought I'd say this, but that song has grown on me. I'll come on to why in a minute, but I'm pleased, mate. Let's talk about your gig. So first gig of the year, the Catalyst is getting its outing. That's a big step, right? Because you've changed over your rig. I think we spoke about it last time. You sold the, I was going to say you sold the Helix, but no, heaven forbid. You sold the Headrush. You sold the Headrush. And now you've got your full Line 6 Catalyst thing going on. Yeah. This is it. So have you figured out what configuration you're running it in for?
I'm going to go just everything, you know, use my standard gig preset straight into the power amp in of the Helix.
Got you.
I'm not going to experiment yet with integrating any of the Catalyst features in, even though I know I can do that. And I pontificated about being able to do that when I was talking about making that decision on a few podcasts ago, I was talking about all the different rig possible possibilities.
Ten. Yeah. There was PowerPoint slides. There was talk of MIDI again, which just made me.
And the chances are that really, what I'm going to do is either go straight into the power amp in from the Helix, or I'm going to have another preset that just doesn't have an amp in, and I'm going to go straight to the front end of the Catalyst and use an internal amp setting. Because the first two or three amp models on the Catalyst, I really, really love. There's a clean setting, which is just pure clean.
Yeah.
Barely breaks up at all. Mm-hmm. Super Fender sounding.
Nice.
It's just fantastic. And then there's this, what's called a boutique setting, which is a bit more kind of like broken up, a bit more kind of like what I'd imagine playing through something like a Lazy J
or something.
Yeah, or maybe something with a little bit more gain, like a Jackson Audio Works, or like a, what are they called? Like Bad Cat, you know, that kind of company.
Yeah,
or something with a bit more gain, something like almost boogie-ish in a way. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like low gain boogie kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then the Vox setting is super chimey, sounds fantastic. Mm-hmm. So there's some really usable amp settings on it, and it is proper loud. And the other good thing about it is it's got like half a watt setting, so I can, even though it's 100 watt amp, I can set it down to half a watt and actually have it really usable as a practice amp, which is kind of cool.
My brain's struggling to think what that actually means, because it's a fully digital amp, right? So it's not like you're power attenuating actual vowels in there, but I guess what it's simulating in this matrix-like world that you now live in is that it's simulating how a valve amp would then break up if it was a lower wattage amp than the modeling of a higher wattage amp.
Yeah, so it will... Right. Well, for a start, it'll be restricting the power output capability of the power amp itself.
Okay.
And you can tell it's doing that because what the master volume does is, there's you've got much more travel before you get up to, loud volumes. But also you can definitely hear there's a change in the gain structure of certain amp settings. So like if I have it, again at a certain point on one of the amps, and I have it on like the 50 watt setting or the 100 watt setting, there's more gain to the sound when I then switch it down to the half watt setting, which is kind of, I think that's what would happen on some amps when you adjust kind of more happening in the preamp or something, or the power amp is therefore clipping sooner because it's got less headroom, if you're giving it less headroom, because you're giving it less voltage. I don't know. I'm on the edge of my electronic knowledge,
Your electronic knowledge knows no bounds. I think that's blowing my mind is like this is like a virtualization of something it's simulating a valve scenario, but it's not.
Yeah,
it's all
exactly.
It's purely digital. But the concept, I totally get. I totally get. Because you get valve amps now, don't you? That's all the rage. No one goes out with 100 watt valve heads anymore.
No,
everyone goes out with like 40 watt, valve amps if they're still using valve amps, like me, the dinosaur that I am. And then if you're lucky, you've got some sort of attenuation on it where you can drop it down and use it at home. But no, mate, super excited for you. I think that's, to be honest, if it was me. You're not me, but because you've got much more technical knowledge on these things, but I would keep it simple like that, which is basically straight into the power amp section. And then you've got all the wonderful simulation of cabs and all of that kind of stuff coming out of your Helix. And you just literally use it as a speaker, but one that's designed for guitar frequencies effectively.
Yeah.
Or you use it as a guitar amp, and you use your Helix as a pedal board, right? And Yeah, it's just exactly a fully digital version of what I do, which is all your pedals are on the Helix, and then it's going into a clean amp as your pedal platform, and the Catalyst simulates whatever amp clean that you want it to be. I think that's
how my head would work. That, Kieran, is because because of the absolute fantastic capabilities of the Helix, is I could have a different pedal board for every song if I wanted.
Oh, Jesus. It's too much. So you love that choice in options. And I did when I was a younger man. And it's maybe because your brain is more agile and plastic to learning than mine is. Mm. But as I get older, I want things to be simpler and not complicated.
And I can appreciate that.
And I just also, because of my OCD and kind of like perfectionist nature, I know that if I opened that Pandora's box to that number of options and possibilities and infinite kind of scenarios, my playing would suffer because I would just forever be playing around with it. Mm. Yours won't. You've got discipline and structure and everything. But I just spend ages tweaking knobs, whereas I know if I let myself, have that as an option, that it will detriment. So I keep it simple purely so that I can just focus on playing the guitar and get it to sound as good as it can to a certain point. And then beyond that, I know, well, there's nothing more I can tweak or fiddle with. So that's it. I'll just carry on. I'll just play now.
Yeah, well, that's fair enough, dude. I mean, I for me, it's horses for courses. If I was back in a blues band, then let's say I have the rig I had now. If I was joining a blues band like we used to be in and just needed a really simple setup wise, I'd probably just replicate that really simple setup.
Yeah, in that'd the be Helix cool, wouldn't
for
it?
Now.
That would
I
be so cool.
crazy. But, no. I also really like, there's some freedom in restriction, isn't there? Do you know what I mean? There's kind of like, if you give yourself kind of the challenge, and I think every guitarist should do this from time to time, is challenge yourself to go out and go and leave the pedal board at home for a gig, go out with just your amp, set up the lead tone you want, and use your volume control to get your clean sounds.
Yeah, that's the ultimate in discipline and
challenge yourself to
cracking
do it.
On.
Challenge yourself to do it, get your clean sound, because I find all the best tones in a guitar not when the volume's all the way up. No. It's kind of when you're choking the guitar back a little bit.
Using the tone controls. And use your fingers to ring out the extra sustain and grit that you need rather than pressing a pedal. Yeah, for sure, man. I totally get that.
There's something really cool about that. But for me, currently, all my gigs are depth gigs for bands that, I'm going from doing Johnny B. Good to Footloose and things like that. I need to have certain sounds. There needs to be certain things for it to work properly.
And
I've got to have chorus here and there, and I've got to have a delay and stuff like that, and maybe a couple of presets. I've got to have a rock sound that sounds Marshally, and I've got to have a rock sound that sounds Fendery.
That's it.
You've got like, you showed me your pedal board recently, didn't you? You sent me a picture of your pedal board.
Yeah.
You've got like six gain stages on there, man. You need a switcher. You need to get yourself a little, preset.
Well, we're going to get a guest on the show. I think it's coming up in a future episode where we're hopefully going to explore switching a little bit more and all of that, because it's a little bit of a minefield. For me, I understand the principles of it, but I've just never built a pedal board with switching capabilities. But I know a man who has, and who is quite obsessive with it, and has got a beautiful pedal board. We'll get him on the show and see if he can convince me. But yes, to your point, I now have six gain stages, and completely kind of in contradiction to what we said is the absolute discipline, which is to just go out with like a guitar amp wound up and the control knobs on your guitar. So, but I am really happy with the pedal board that I have and the pedals selection that I've been using for the last kind of probably 12 months, maybe coming on for. And up until recently, it was basically five gain stages. What I would say is only ever maximum three of them will be active at any one point. One, two, three. Checking in my head. Only three of them will ever be active at one stage. So I have separate pedals that give me exactly what you just described, which is I've got my Marshall in a box pedal, for those kind of JCM 800 Silver Jubilee type rock tones that I need. That's one pedal. I've got another pedal, which is more of my kind of, I don't know what amp it would be like, but it's more like a kind of orange, as in the amp brand, yeah. kind of gritty, maybe slightly Mesa Boogie. It can go up to, but it's a different drive tone.
Yeah.
Slightly less, it's quite a bit less saturated, but it's still creamy. Mm-hmm. And it's a great tone for stereophonics type numbers and things like that.
Yeah.
It's got that kind of drive.
I love
that.
So, I know what you mean. It's quite hard to describe the orange sound because there's almost an edge of like, it's kind of like whenever I hear a sort of really nicely wound up and loud orange amp, there's always kind of part that goes, is there a fuzz pedal going on there?
Yeah,
like a exactly. Morgan kind of fuzz thing. There's something really cool that's about it. That compression that an orange amp has. It's because it's a compression, bit crazy, isn't it?
Compression. That's the word, mate. Thank you for that's exactly it. It's got this compression to it, which my Marshall in a box pedal doesn't have, and it's just a tighter drive, but not stupidly crazy. And that is coming from the pedal that you recommended to my good lady wife to buy for me for my birthday maybe a couple of years ago. That's the Weihuge STO.
STO, that's right.
Which I'm loving. I'm absolutely loving with a humbucker bass guitar. It just is brilliant.
Mm.
So that's that pedal. And then I've got my Love Pedal Super 6 as my kind of better than a Tube Screamer, Texas Dirt, Stevie Ray Vaughan esque pedal. So those are my three main gain pedals, right?
Yeah.
And invariably, only one of those will ever be active, right? As my main thing. Then what I will do is either side of that pedal, there'll be the option to kick on the Klon clone, my now infamous Wish.com Klon clone, to kind of before one of those pedals, just to give it a little bit of a push.
It's almost like an EQ, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly right, mate. Yeah, it's almost like an EQ. But sometimes I don't need it, so that one stays off. But if it's there, it can EQ it a little bit and push one of those, depending on the song. And then post one of those pedals, I have a boost for just lifting the volume of it all, just to punch in for solos, right? So that's my three gain stages, but then with different tonal options. So, but yeah, I sent you a photo the other day because for the last few gigs, I've been using the again now infamous TC Electronic Spark Boost, right, as my boost pedal.
Yeah,
For volume drop-ins, and I love it. It's got such a beautiful, punchy, chunky tone to it. It's muscular. It's a muscular sounding boost pedal, right? Which I love. And so I've been using that, and it's got bags of headroom on it, and that what they call that prime time function. I think we call it that momentary function where it intuitively just pushes in and you can hold it there and have a momentary boost, like a drop in, right? And then you can release or you can click it fully on. That function is genius. Yeah. Why it's the only pedal on the market, to my knowledge, that has that function, God only knows. It is a game changer, right?
Yeah.
It's a game changer. I thought the first gig that I did with it, I thought this is going to get a bit of getting used to. I hadn't even played with it at home before I took it to a gig. I just put it on the board, went, we've talked about this so much, I'm sure I'll figure it out. Within the first song, I'd got it. It's like picking up an Apple iPhone. It didn't need instructions. It just worked, right? It just worked. And that was it. I was sold. I was like, this is brilliant, right?
Yeah.
So that's the benefits. The downside is I really miss the EQ and gain controls that my previous boost pedal, the Moore Pure Boost, which I've used for the last 10 years, and it's never let me down. I miss being able to just dial up the gain a little bit for a bit more compression and being able to EQ the boost, right? So what I actually do is I cut some of the bass the low end on it. Just dime it back a little bit, and just dime up the treble a little bit for a little bit of clean push, just to help it cut through the mix on a solo, right?
Of course.
So that pedal gives me a little bit more sustain because of the gain knob on it that you can tweak slightly. And then that EQ again for solos just punches in beautifully, but it doesn't obviously have that momentary prime time function. So that's the one thing that I wish TC Electronic would do. So if they're listening, like, make a Spark Boost, please, which has the EQ settings that the big full fat one has.
Yeah.
But put the prime time function on it, because their bigger version of the Spark Boost doesn't have that function. Just it's only on the mini version.
You're right.
It's only on the mini version. They're missing a trick. I don't get it.
I think I don't think they made enough fuss about that prime time function enough anywhere when they released it. Did they?
They didn't.
So not enough people know what them. I'm sure there's plenty of people out there that don't realise what they're missing out on. And they've even got that pedal on the board, probably.
It's so cool. Anyway, we've given them enough promotion over the years now and mentioned that pedal enough to the point where now people are buying it because they've heard it on the
podcast. Yeah, big Rare Ball one, didn't he? You put it on the Guitar Geek Highland. There we go.
It's a cracking pedal.
We're actually selling this thing for you. I hope you're managing okay with it, Ray, by the way. It's a good pedal.
Yeah. Oh, mate, it's a beautiful pedal. You won't regret it. Mm-hmm. But having said that, I did send you a picture the other day saying, now for my volume solo boost thing, I've now put the Spark Boost side by side on the board with the Moore Pure Boost.
So you stand on both at the same time?
No, hopefully not. That would be disastrously loud. But basically, I'm now literally using, or intending to, let's see how this goes tomorrow. It may be one step too far for my small mind, and I end up tap dancing my way through a gig and having to rip one of them off the board. But in my mind, I'm now going to use the TC Electronic Spark Boost purely for that prime time function, for little cheeky drop-ins where I need it to.
Yeah.
And for my main solos, where I want that EQ function and that little bit of extra compression and sustain on the solo, because it's a longer solo and I just want that, I'm going to use the Moore. So now I've got two options as to which pedal I'm going to hit for solos, depending. It's too much, isn't it? It's just too much. I'm going to have to take one of them off, but let's see how it goes.
I don't think it's too much. I think you've got a plan in mind as to how you're going to use them. I think there's a lot of guitarists out there that will have plenty more gain stages on their board. Or, you know, it's not about too much, Kieran. I think it's about why you have them there in the context of the music you're playing with your band. And if you know in your mind anyway that you're always kind of thinking, well, really what I've got is for any given song, you've got a clean sound and an appropriate dirty sound and then an appropriate way of you either adding more gain and volume for a solo, whether that's through the boost or the clone or whatever like that. So you've got six gain stages and the permutations are endless as to what you can select, but you've already got it clear in your mind how you're going to use them for any given song.
Exactly.
So in that way, I don't think it's extravagant or gratuitous at all. I, what I would say, though, is that, you know, you're doing a lot of tap dancing. Whether or not it's worth you spending the money on some kind of, you know, switching system that allows you to set presets so you can have a preset that is these gain pedals and a preset that is that gain pedal. You might find that there's no real benefit to that for you because that's quite an expensive, you know, upgrade to a pedal board that's really only saving you a few moments clicking at, you know, beginning and end of guitar solos.
Yeah, but so, it'd be fun though, wouldn't it?
It'd be cool.
Because what I've got to do now, and thank you for validating my insanity, but I, as I said, I will still only ever have three of these pedals on at any one point.
Yeah.
But what it now forces me to do is exactly as you've described, is for each song in the set list, I've got in my head which combination of those three pedals it is. So I've now got to kind of remember for each song.
Yeah.
It's those three pedals. It's those three pedals. Whereas if I had a switching system that just was kind of, nicely labeled out, I could just press one button and it would be those three pedals.
Exactly.
And then disengage it and those pedals come out the signal chain, and then press another button and it's those three pedals.
Yeah. That's it. And also when you're not actually using any pedals, your signals are not going through any of those pedals, whether they're off or on. That's the other cool thing about a switching system, is because it's a true bypass. When you're not engaging that loop with the pedal in that's already on, your signal's not even going through that loop at all. So if you have nothing switched on, you're literally going straight from your guitar into your amp, so you end up with a more pure sound. You know, and the argument is you also get less noise because you're not picking up noise through all those different pedals, even when they're not engaged. So
exactly,
there's a lot of arguments for having that system in terms of protecting your tone, but you know, it's not everyone needs it.
No, well, let's see how I get on tomorrow. I've got a gig tomorrow down in Fareham. Let's see how it goes. Is it too much tap dancing? Is it too much to remember? Has it added this extra pedal? Has it compromised my tone by adding another pedal? Has it increased the noise floor? I don't know. Let's see. Is it too much? If it works and I like it, but it's just a bit too much tap dancing, then switching system, here we come.
Can't wait.
Well, let's debrief next week and see how our respective equipment performed.
Excellent. Looking forward to it. Shall we get on with what we're talking about today? Because I'm looking forward to this one. This is an interesting one.
I feel like
this is close to my heart in a way. Kieran, what are we talking about today? Sorry to interrupt this conversation. However, if you're a regular listener, then you should definitely come and join us on our Facebook group, The Guitar Geek Hangout. You can interact with other listeners of the show, engage in general chit-chat about guitars, music and pedals, or just share images of your guitar collection for everyone to look at. Regardless, it's the next place you should visit online. Go and join The Guitar Geek Hangout on Facebook now before you carry on with the podcast. I'll wait here. Hey, welcome back.
We're talking about why you need to spend more money on guitars.
You need
to spend some cash, serious cash this time. Both of us, we're going to go crazy because clearly, Matt, the more money we spend on a guitar, the better we're going to be.
That's true. That is actually a fact, isn't it? I think the best, you're absolutely right. Your ability as a guitarist is entirely proportionate to the amount of money you spend on your instrument, isn't it? That is a true fact, isn't it?
Here endeth the lesson. Well, brilliant. I think certain manufacturers would. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's it. Tune in next week. No, our topic is on a related theme, isn't it? Which is discussing this notion. Discussing actually the reality of an expensive guitar and what that means for your playing, for your wallet, for your just overall coolness, really.
Overall coolness. That is an important point. I think, for me, it's an interesting subject because I've never owned what I would consider to be an expensive guitar. And I think we've set some boundaries right as well. I think we've said to ourselves beforehand, and it'd be interesting to see what people agree with here. But we've kind of said an expensive guitar is what, £1,500 or above. You know, I don't know what we're looking at there for terms of US dollars. Let's, for argument's sake, say $1,500 as well.
Sure.
You know, so we're talking high end Strat upwards, aren't we? We're talking, well, anything from Gibson.
Pretty much.
A Gibson wallet, you know. let's not get down that road too much today. Gibson bashing. But we're kind of talking about, you know, how does having an expensive instrument really affect your ability as a guitarist? Is it really worth having that kind of instrument in your life, and you know, what are you gaining when you spend that amount of money on a guitar? That's really what is lingering in my mind in terms of questions. But I know you're in a different position than I am, Kieran, because you do have kind of what I would consider experience in both ends of the market, because you are a fan of really good value guitars. I know you love gigging your Tokais, and you've got some other, you know, you've got some Epiphones, but you do also own some, you know, some, you've got a couple of, you've got a high end Fender, haven't you? And you've got a couple of, you know, you got some nice Gibsons as well in your collection. So, you know, you're coming from a position of experience.
Some experience. I still think, well, I tell you what, mate, having had a look, today, because that's the first question, as you've rightly said, is like, what are we talking about when we're saying expensive? Now, it depends on obviously individual circumstances and financially what situation somebody's in, right? One man's $200 guitar could be expensive to somebody else or cheap to somebody else. So there's always that. But I guess where I came at it from today was from what we talk about a lot on this podcast, which is the kind of jobbing guitarist, right? The kind of people like you and I who are, you know, we're not super rich, we're not super poor, we're kind of doing okay in life, and we go out and we gig, and it's kind of like, well, how much do we want to spend on the guitar? What's reasonable? So in my head, I just thinking about it, I thought, do you know what? Anything above like $5,000, $6,000, that for me goes into the realms of like wall art or, you know, at worst vanity, maybe, or just the fact that, you know, it's something that is an investment piece, or like you've won a piece of money or something like that. Piece of money, you inherited some money. You know, that's like really expensive. And I don't think there's any real benefit beyond quality and playability and things. This is just super expensive guitars. But I think up to like $5,000, $6,000, pounds, whatever you want to call it, and going from around the bottom end, like to, as you said, 1500, that kind of mid-range, that kind of range, I would say those are expensive instruments, and it's kind of worth us discussing, is it worth it? You know, what do they give? What do they give you?
I think that's the key question, right? What is the difference between a good jobbing guitar, like what I've got behind me, you know, that Mexican classic player Strat, that's a good guitar. That is a decent, you know, that's a decent, well, you know, well-spec guitar. It's got, I believe it's an older body. I don't think it's basswood or anything like that. It's still got a rosewood fretboard. It's still got a maple neck. It's still the classic configuration of tone woods that you would get. It had decent pickups on it. I've changed one of the pickups on it since, but specification-wise, it's still, you know, on paper, reads very much the same way as you would read, you know, a more expensive Strat. What are the differences, right? So let's talk about what are you paying for when you pay that extra dollar for that compared to something like that Mexican Strat that I've got. And for me, surely some of it has got to be the hardware, you know, obviously the pickups and stuff. But for me, I've always been convinced of this. A huge amount of what you're paying for is simply time spent with hands on that guitar from an experienced luthier, you know, and having, you know, and likewise, you can kind of turn it backwards and look at it the opposite way and say, well, how come that guitar is so much cheaper than this one? And it's because less time spent with somebody really putting time and effort into making that guitar right. You know, it's kind of the more that could be automated in the process of building that guitar, then the less it costs for the manufacturer. So, you know, for me, that's the value I think I can see, at least in, if I was like, for example, if I was going to go, and I'm looking at a guitar now as an example, I thought I'm going to go online, go on one of the guitar stores online that has, you know, a huge amount of availability here in the UK and just pick out something that is kind of, you know, what I would consider the kind of instrument, a pro gigging musician who's out there on big stages doing proper sessions and proper gigs would buy. And I've chosen a John Sir Classic S, you know.
Yeah, nice.
You know, somebody who wants a Strat and they want to get themselves an absolute premium Strat. And that's, you know, that's over £3,000 worth of Strat, which I, you know, I still find crazy in a way, because Strats were designed to be instruments that could be bolted together by people who have no idea how to build an instrument. It's not like a jazz box from, you know, the Angelico that might take months to make because you're carving wood down into extremely thin pieces of wood so that they vibrate perfectly. It's not like a Martin acoustic where you're shaving away small pieces of maple from the, you know, from the bracing inside so that it vibrates properly and evenly. It's a Strat. It's components mass produced and bolted together. I'm a big fan of a guitarist called Alan Hines. I don't know if you've you've heard of him, and his playing is just absolutely just awesome. You know, really smooth, kind of articulate guitarist. You know, kind of bluesy fusion. You know, and he's got some great videos on his YouTube channel of what makes this guitar great and affordable, kind of thing. Okay. He's showing some of the guitars from his collection, and he's got this 1960s Strat. But it's not a 60 Strat. He's not bought a 60 Strat. He said he's actually collected the components over time.
Oh, really?
And I think the one that he was showing, he said over time it's cost him about $4,000. If he was buying it now, obviously we'd be talking $40,000 as a complete instrument. But he said it's no bother to him that he's built this guitar himself out of random components that he's found over a long period of time.
All components from the 60s that would have been on a 60s Strat.
From the 60s. Exactly.
What a great idea.
So he's
love that
he's
idea.
Dropped on a 60s body from somewhere. Okay, I'll buy that for $1,000 or whatever. And then he's dropped onto like a 60s neck somewhere. And it's not like, you know, it's not like it's a complete instrument that came out of the workshop at any one point. But he said he made the argument. He said these guitars were designed to just be bolted together, you know.
Look at Clapton's Blackie.
Well, there you go.
That's one of the most expensive guitars ever sold. Nearly a million dollars.
$1 million. Yeah, you're right.
$960,000. And that was a mashup of. I'm guessing it was a mashup of 60s Strat parts.
They were 50s Strats. Yeah, 50s. So they were 50s Strats. 50s. That's right. So he bought six in a shop in Nashville. I can't remember the name of the shop, but we've spoken about this before. Yeah, he gifted three of them. Steve Winwood, one to George Harrison,
one to Pete Townsend,
and then with the three he had left, he built Blackie out of the favorite parts that he liked, which pickup sounded the best, which neck felt the best, and brilliant. So it was a mongrel of three 1950 Strats. But he said because that was a time in the 70s when you could still pick up an old Strat for $100. So he was at Showbud. That was it. Showbud Music in Nashville, I think it was. And he said he went in the back and they had a rack of old 50 Strats, $100 each. He just grabbed them all because he was playing with Donnie Bramlett and Bonnie Bramlett at the time, and he was getting into Strats after coming off Gibsons because they were playing Strats. And he just went into this shop and just like, oh, buy that. If you've got a rack of 100 old, six old, Strats for $100 each, I'll just take them and gifted the ones he didn't want, built a Strat out of
That's giving me a weird feeling of like, I don't know.
But it goes to show that even back then, people understood what the Strat really was, which was this kind of simplification of the guitar. Let's swing back around to what the hell we're talking about.
Why
is it that I have to spend £3,300 now on this John Sir Strat?
Well, so you mentioned time spent on the guitar, right? By hands versus automation. And I do think you're right, to a point, particularly when you're talking about things that are coming out of custom shops and Murphy Labs and, these premium luthiers for the big brands, right? Because clearly you're paying for their attention on a guitar, even something like a bolt-on Strat. I think there is a layer underneath that, which is similar, but probably even more fundamental, which is not so much about hands on the guitar and versus automation, but it is purely the difference in labor costs between countries, right? That's probably one of the, in my mind, the biggest driver. So if we think of the big three in this arena, Gibson, Fender, and PRS, mm-hmm. and I know we speak a lot about those, but you know, as we discussed on our review of best-selling guitars from the last few years, that episode we did a couple of weeks back, it's still those guys that are, you know, still selling in droves on those lists. And actually, when you look at the kind of price bracket that we're talking about for expensive guitars, it's those three brands that dominate. Mm-hmm. And it's because of the US labor costs associated with those brands coming out of those factories, right? You're paying for the labor costs difference between a guitar made by somebody in America in an American factory versus what could arguably be as skilled a luthier who could be spending as much time with their hands on the guitar potentially, but they are based in Korea or Vietnam. Now, I don't want to get into the morals and ethics and fairness of that or the economics of it, but I think that is probably one of the biggest drivers. So, you know, that's what you're bearing. And then there's a kudos and a prestige, again, rightly or wrongly, and we won't get into to the nuances of that. And God knows we love and don't have any snobbery around where a guitar is made, but for some, that's important. Or maybe they just want to support the workforce that has built it and say, you know, I want to support US kind of luthiers, so I'm going to buy US made guitars. Whatever, there is a difference in costs of where those guitars are made. That's the first thing. And then brand name, as we've just discussed, comes into it. So that's probably for me the one big differentiator. Then you get exactly, as you said, into, well, what's on the guitar? What hardware's on it? What tuners are on it? What pickups are on it? What tone woods is it made of?
Yeah.
What's the finish on it? What's the aesthetics? I mean, good Lord, you know, that PRS private stock wood library where
this is quite a more complex conversation than I thought we were going to have. You know, in the sense that as I'm thinking about it and thinking, do you know what, that price tag of that guitar I'm looking at right now, this Sir Classic S Antique Sonic Blue HSS Strat, you know, I'm looking at it and it's £3,299 here in the UK with this particular vendor. And I'm thinking, you know, that price tag there is a very complex kind of... what's the word I'm looking for? It's a very complex sum of many different and complex things, isn't it?
Yeah,
and I think that's what we're maybe not appreciating, is we're maybe simplifying this conversation. Or maybe in my mind, I thought this was a simpler conversation than it was before we had it, which was, you know, is it really just a linear scale between better and worse, cheaper and expensive? And I don't think it is. I think it's much more complex than that. It's not those two things aren't even necessarily linked. An expensive guitar can play extremely badly without the right attention to detail.
An
extremely cheap guitar can play beautifully and sound amazing just by chance that it's been put together in a really, really good way. And actually the cheap components that it has just sometimes happen to all work together perfectly. And you end up with something where you kind of just scratch your head and go, how is it possible for this instrument to feel and play this well? There's so many different factors that play into why a guitar is good.
And I think there is a generalization. I think your generalization is correct in that at the two ends of those spectrums, you should, as a general rule, expect a more expensive premium guitar costing thousands and thousands of pounds, dollars, to play better and feel better and sound better than a cheaper made instrument should do, because of the component parts, how much time has been spent on it, et cetera, but God knows we love some of those not stupidly cheap and nasty guitars, but some of those guitars that just have been produced in mass volume, not for price perspective, had that much time spent on them, but with a bit of tweaking, refinement, potentially a few little upgrades, can be just, well, my Tokais are a case in point, made in China, few electronic upgrades, a good setup, from me, and they are just to me as good as any Gibson Les Paul that I've played. And I've got, as you said, Gibson Les Paul. So yeah, it's an interesting one, but it is multifactorial. It is based on geography, and it's not a linear thing. There is a point of diminishing returns, though, right? Yeah. Which is to a point. Beyond what price point does it actually? You're just paying for aesthetics or brand, and you're not getting any benefit. And yeah. I don't know what that point is. I guess it differs by manufacturer, really.
Well, I reckon I could. I've got an idea as to what one of those things that you could pay for, which is your diminishing returns, if you like. So okay. Take PRS, for example.
Yeah.
One of the things that I find the most astonishing about what PRS do is the effort and time and money spent into managing the tone wood selection and then how they store and look after all those different tone woods. You know, there are kind of palettes of maple and rosewood and things that PRS sit in ovens for months at a time to dry them out to a certain level. But how are you experiencing that difference in that guitar? You might pick up a PRS guitar and you've got no way of comparing that to anything else on the earth. Do you know what I mean? You could pick up a cheaper PRS and think, well, actually, I can't really hear or feel the difference in that different tone wood selection. But the tone wood selection between those two guitars might be a $2,000 increase in price.
For sure.
You could actually be spending thousands more on a guitar simply because of the cost inherent in providing that particular tone wood selection that you've made. But actually, there might be no experiential difference between that guitar and a cheaper guitar. It's just that you've bought into a process of supplying that particular type of wood because you want to know that a certain selection has been made. Do you see what I mean? It's kind of you're spending thousands on something that doesn't really give you anything other than the knowledge of something that has been
done. Or does it? I'm sure Paul Reed Smith would argue differently as he sips his iced bourbon in the candlelit vaults of the PRS Wood Library, which smells of rich mahogany and leather bound books, you know. And occasionally has John Mayer popping McCallum, by.
That's it.
Do you remember that? The optimist in me says it's about marginal gains. And every little extra attention to detail and little tweak from drying out that wood or talking to it while it was growing on the tree to massaging it before chopping it down. is that Wagyu maple? I don't know. this guitar is made of gently treated Wagyu maple.
That's it. The marbling of the fat is fantastic.
It's finished in Kobe nitrocellulose. I don't know where I'm going with this. No, is it marginal gains? Is it marginal gains? Right, where each little element actually creates something that is that extra bit special when you put all of those different things together: the hand wound pickups, the you know, all of these bits. Or is it, from my cynical brain and pessimistic viewpoint, is it all just marketing bullshit? And really, there is no such thing as tone woods when it comes to an electric guitar, because you cover the whole thing in polyurethane varnish, and all that really matters is what your string is made of and what your pickups are doing. Everything else is just either there for ease of playability or aesthetics or to charge a higher price, because it's just nonsense. Probably somewhere in the middle, and that's why we will forever have guitar acquisition syndrome and a quest for this kind of stuff. But I think it is, to your point, multifactorial. Do you want to see something cool?
Yeah, I do.
I found a guitar that I thought of. I thought of me. I was like, oh yeah, I'd definitely buy that. But then I thought of you. So have a click in the chat on link number 3. I didn't know these existed.
Number 3.
But I was just like, oh, hello. Hello, expensive guitar. Yeah.
So we're looking at, tell the people what we're looking at here. so that I can make sure I'm looking at the right thing.
As I often do, I covet things that I shouldn't. But I was looking at these expensive, in inverted comma, guitars within the range that we're talking about. As like, how much would I spend on a guitar that I would take out every weekend and gig? But I would know it's a really expensive guitar, but I'd still gig it rather than it being a piece of wall art. And I found this, and it goes back to what you were saying earlier about a bolt-on Fender Strat, effectively,
but
being really expensive, right? So this is the Fender Custom Shop Elite Stratocaster in your, and I think my favorite finish, pewter. With a mid boost, so it's got your Clapton circuitry, but it's got a double A flame roasted maple fingerboard.
It's a beautiful guitar.
Basically £4,000. But that's just delicious. Mm. It's stunning. I don't know.
It really is absolutely beautiful.
That looks cool. So then you click on something like that, right? And then you go. Then you start to justify why that expensive guitar is just going to make your dreams come true. Flame roasted maple neck's going to sound brilliant. All those appointments on it. Fender Custom Shop.
Yeah,
it's a lot of guitar.
I think this is. I think the Fender Custom Shop for me. And maybe we can say the same thing about the Murphy Lab and the Gibson Custom Shop as well. I think these are the places where you really get to see and understand why these guitars that they produce at the price they produce them feel and probably look so much better than non-custom shop guitars, because these custom shops tend to be a small team of people who are dedicated to kind of not just building a range of guitars. You know, we're not talking about somebody whose job it is to, hey, you know, I'm on the production line and I do the setup and I do the fret leveling of all the guitars that come through. The Fender Custom Shops, from what I understand, tend to be this custom master builder gets given this commission of a guitar that somebody's ordered, and it's their job to then build that guitar from start to finish and deliver it back to them. If that person's paid for that, if they've paid for a specific master builder.
That's a different one, I think, isn't it? I think that is the master built custom shop.
Exactly.
I don't know how many hands have touched this one, arguably more than the master built, but still, I'd like to think this guitar is set up to perfection, plays beautifully, is just have that attention to detail in assembling exactly what you said, those component parts, to make it just one of the best Strats you've ever played and heard and looked at.
For example, installing the pickups on this guitar on a cheaper Strat, that would have been somebody with a stack of pickups next to them, and the guitars come through and they would have put it in the scratch plate, built the scratch plate, wired everything up quickly, soldered it, screwed it all into place, and then it goes on to its next thing. Whereas I'd imagine, for a custom shop, you know, that guy, you know, whoever's building this instrument, that person is probably very carefully selecting the components, measuring resistances and making sure that everything fits within a certain tolerance, and then getting the covers and making sure that the color of the plastic is, do you know what I mean? The time spent, the equivalent time spent completing the pick guard on that cheaper instrument is probably spent just like looking at one very small detail on this. And it's, I think that's the thing. Like you say, it's labor, isn't it? So if you take into account the cost for Fender to pay somebody to build a custom shop guitar, you've got to pay for that time spent on it. And that's where I see, and then you feel that, you will feel that in your playing experience. I do think you feel that. I'll tell you why. Here's a quick example why.
Go.
I'm learning now that it's the time spent looking at the details of by a good technician that makes a guitar great to play, is because I've just done this thing myself after your three episodes talking about how to set up. Just 2 nights ago, I had the neck off my Strat. I'd taken the strings off and I thought, do you know what? I'm going to take the neck off completely. I checked the relief. I thought, I've got room for maybe a quarter turn less relief on this to bring the action down. Do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take the neck off. I'm going to lemon oil it. I'm going to fret polish every fret, get it shining. You know, I'm going to very carefully, whilst like listening to something, just like lubricated the nut slots perfectly, and lubricated everything. I polished everything, got all the dust off of everything, you know, and I just spent a good hour and a half whilst watching a movie, just getting the Strat as perfect as I could, got the string radius, got the action as low as it could. It's now got an action lower than it's ever had, and it's not buzzing out anywhere, even though it still kind of needs a fret dress. And now it feels like twice the guitar it was even after I did that job the last time.
For sure.
Because of just time spent working on the details, right? It's not about the... I'm sure if it had a more expensive piece of tone wood on the, you know, that the neck was built out of, I'm sure it wouldn't actually play any better if I'd set it up the same way as I've just set that up now. So for me, that's what you're paying for. I think when you're paying for a $3,000 or $4,000 instrument, you're paying for someone with decades of experience imparting that experience into the setup and the build of that guitar in a way that you will never get when that guitar is pumped off a production line that's full of people and machines that don't have that experience. I mean, all those people in the custom shop are guitar players for a start, you know, that makes a difference, right? Anyway.
No, you are right. You are right. And that is... that is what you would hope and often I'm sure will get with paying for a more expensive instrument. The bit that frustrates me as it will now frustrate you, now you know how to do these things on a guitar, is when you pick up a really expensive guitar and it hasn't been set up properly and it hasn't been kind of had that care and attention to it, and you just go, oh, that's a shame. It should have that. Or the flip side of it. Like where I've taken these Tokais and they weren't great out of the box. They were okay, but with a few tweaks and some attention, they just turned into miraculous instruments. So yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Too often I found myself coveting these really expensive instruments, getting down to the guitar shop, trying them out, and then being disappointed and going, it's not what I thought it would be. But yeah. Yeah, interesting.
It is interesting. I think there's a huge element of failure in the industry, I think, to really make sure these instruments are at their best when they eventually go on the wall at the shop, you know.
Yeah. But does a more expensive guitar make you play better? Does it make you a better guitarist?
This is the thing.
Right.
Go on.
Well, I was going to say, let's take setup and... things out of the equation for a moment then. So let's imagine we've got a mid-priced instrument, a modest guitar, set up well, set up nicely, plays nicely, and we've got something really premium and expensive that's also equally set up well and nicely and playing well. Are you going to play better or have a different experience between those two guitars now? Now that things like setup and time spent on the guitar have been taken out of the equation, what are we talking about then between the playing experience of those two instruments?
It's a really good question. And you know what? I'm trying to picture myself doing this to acoustic guitars rather than electric because there's too many things in the signal chain of electric guitars, I think, can, you know, that detract from the experience. And I'm thinking, you know, if I'm playing a £2,000 Martin compared to, say, a £200 Yamaha, I'd like to think that I would experience the difference in those instruments.
I think you would.
Maybe
even though they're set up nicely
with acoustics.
Yeah. I think it might be. I think you would hear that because of all the things you talked about earlier and how the bracing's been done, what the tone woods are. Tone woods for sure matter in acoustics and all of that. There is something that happens when I sit down with an expensive guitar that's been set up well and plays nicely. And there is a feeling that I get that I'm playing something special. And it does make me feel differently. Does it make me any better a player or anything? No, I'm not sure. But I do connect with the instrument if it's in the right environment in a way that just feels special, right? Yeah. It's like putting on your best watch when you're going out for dinner somewhere or something like that, where it becomes a moment where you go, I'm going to sit down and play this expensive guitar. It gives you a feeling. It's hard to describe. I don't know whether I'm on my own with that.
No, I don't think you are. I kind of get it. You know, I really do, because even though I've never owned an expensive guitar, I have gone from, you know, from one place to another. You know, what I've made what's felt like a significant jump in quality, and it does feel different. It is inspiring. I think I wouldn't say, for me, I don't think having a more expensive guitar helps to, or indeed makes you a better guitarist. But I think if that guitar in some way, I think more expensive guitars do offer more opportunity for you to connect with your instrument in a positive way, because they're made better, or you could argue they're made better with better materials. And I think there's less opportunity for you to become frustrated with your instrument if it's a more expensive instrument, maybe. And that, therefore, I think leads to you having a better experience when you're playing. I think if everything is out of the way when you're playing your guitar, whether it's the setup, the sound, frustrations with your sound, if all that stuff that gets in the way as you're playing is out of the way, you're going to feel like you're playing better, and you're going to feel like you've got less in the way of your playing. And I think maybe there is a better chance of that with more expensive instruments. But that's where it stops for me, because if I'm sat next to Guthrie Govan, and we swap guitars, there's no way he's going to sound any worse than he did on that $3,000 Charvel, signature instrument that he's got. And there's no way that I'm suddenly going to be able to sweep pick and, you know what I mean, and play on his instrument. I don't think it's analogous that you're better or worse with more expensive. That's to do with time spent playing more than anything else. But that's my feeling about it.
I have the same feeling. Like, set your guitar up, whatever your guitar is, to the absolute best that it can be set up, and spend time practicing, and that's going to make you a better player. If you've got the budget to spend more money on a guitar, spend it. Absolutely spend it, because hopefully what you will get is then a better investment on that guitar. Something that when you do set it up will set up nicer and stay set up for longer in a nicer way. I think that was really poor grammar there, but what I'm trying to say is, you know, setting up a well-made instrument and a more expensive instrument, in my experience, is generally a better outcome than trying to rescue something that's dog cheap. But be aware that there is a point of diminishing returns on this, and up to a price point, you are then paying for where the guitar has been made and the brand of it and some of the marketing elements behind it. And
that's true. Yeah.
There's the other mistake that I've made, definitely, but that's just more out of financial circumstances over the years and what happens as you get older. But, you know, is it better to have lots of cheap guitars or one or two really expensive guitars, right? Cumulatively, how much have I spent on cheap, crappy guitars that I've then had to set up, upgrade parts on, change this, change that?
Yeah.
Whereas actually, if I'd have just spent the money on less guitars but better, more expensive ones, I'd have got arguably some nicer guitars at the end of it and still spent the same amount of money. So there's that interesting conundrum as well, which is what I'm saying. If you've got some money, set a budget and spend up to that and enjoy it. But I don't think there's anything wrong with buying expensive guitars, is what I think I'm saying.
I don't think there's anything wrong with buying expensive guitars. But you know what? I'm going to finish on one little tip, which I think is the middle ground. We've not talked about the middle ground, right? And I think there's something to be learned from the marketplace today, because there are some manufacturers out there that sit in the middle, I think, between what you would consider expensive. Some that are doing things really well, and actually they're doing things in a way not dissimilar to how those expensive brands do things, and you can just pay a fraction of the price. And one of those brands, I think, is Eastman. So, you know, they make a lot of really nice looking kind of Gibson derivative designs, you know, not quite 335 shape, not quite a Les Paul shape, but they make some beautiful instruments all between kind of $1,000 and $2,000, you know. But they're made out of China, and a lot of people go, well, why would I want a Chinese instrument? Well, actually, what Eastman have done is they've set up the equivalent of kind of like a custom shop in China. So their instruments are built by a small team of people. And most parts of what they build are handmade and hand finished. And I've tried an Eastman out before over at Guitar Village in the UK, and it was built to perfection. In the end, I chose, instead of buying an Eastman, to buy two cheaper guitars because I wanted, you know, I wanted the guitars that I wanted. I knew I had my heart set on anyway, but I wanted to try the Eastman. And I was blown away by the quality of it. But the point is that that's a brand that is building guitars out in the Far East where labor is cheaper, but they're still using a lot of time and a lot of expertise and a lot of people who really know what they're doing to spend time on their instruments. So if we're talking about a brand, you know, if we're talking about the quality of instruments being directly proportional to how much time spent on them by an expert during their build process, rather than just having automated, you know, things going from one place to another to just, you know, build things step by step. You know, find those brands like Eastman that are still trying to do things in a qualitative way in a place in the world where, you know, it costs less to do that.
That's why I love Japanese guitars.
Yes,
I think the Japanese made guitars for me represent that sweet point. I've seen so many of them now that I just think, this is an incredible instrument that's finished well, set up well. You can tell that the hands that have been on it have cared and given the attention to detail. But invariably, they sell for cheaper because they're not made in America. Don't get me wrong; love American built guitars. I've got plenty of them. But thinking of brands like the Japanese made Tokai stuff, the stuff coming out of the Fujigen, Bacchus kind of factories, they're just incredibly made instruments.
Dare I say it, Kieran? But are Japanese instruments experiencing a bit of a resurgence of late?
I seem to hear a lot more about them recently, whether that's just because the algorithms are working and Google is always listening to me and therefore it appears on my social media page more often and things like that. I'm not sure, but I'm starting to see them becoming more readily available in this country, that, you know, which is a sign of something. Oftentimes some of these instruments didn't really leave Japan and were made for the domestic market. Yeah. So they're quite difficult to get hold of in this country particularly. But I'm not sure that's the same if you live in Australia or places like that where you've got more ready access to Far East instruments. But I think there's an appreciation that people have always had for Japanese made instruments. It's just whether you can get hold of them or not in the country that you live in, which is not as easy to do in the UK. And they sit in that bracket, which is they're more expensive to make and the labour costs are higher than places like Korea and Vietnam and Indonesia, where we see some of the budget instruments coming out of. Good instruments, but budget. And they don't sit as high as the American costs. So I think for me, there's a lot of Japanese instruments that hit that sweet spot.
Well, I mentioned it because I know that recently... I just put a link in the chat. Andertons here in the UK announced that they started stocking FGN, the Fujigen guitars. So the entire range of FGN guitars is now available at Andertons. I'm sure others, I think there's some other retailers do, but there's a whole range of very nice looking kind of Fender derivative models from FGN. And I've seen some reviews online. One of the guys that I like to look at online, John Cordy, who does a lot of modeling stuff with like Helix and Fractal, but also does a lot of guitar reviews. He recently did a review of one of the FGN and just said it was probably the best guitar for the money he's ever played for, you know, for the amount of money that it cost, equivalent, you know, other guitars at that price range, you know, probably didn't come close, and he's tried a lot of them. Speaks for itself.
Well, do you remember I tried some of these guitars out a couple of years ago? Do you remember the distributor at the time, one of the only distributors in the UK for Bacchus and
FGN? It was literally around the corner from you, isn't it?
Yeah. He lived in the same village. And I went around, he kindly invited me around to his house to try out some of these guitars. And I fell in love with them.
Yeah.
I thought they were just absolutely superb. Bacchus, FGN instruments, Japanese made instruments. I was just like, wow, they're incredible. Absolutely superb. Not cheap, but not stupidly expensive, but had that perfect sweet spot. And it's going to be disastrous on my wallet to know that Andertons are now stocking them as well. That sounds like a day trip, doesn't it?
It does sound like a day trip. They've got some nice looking instruments.
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Well, there we go. I bet they're spiked beautifully.
They will be.
Well, I don't know if we've concluded this conversation. I feel like I need to go and experience playing some expensive guitars, more than I have done in my life. As a 40-year-old man who's played guitar since I was, a very early teen, I feel like the one thing I've missed out on so far is really getting my hands on some expensive instruments and really seeing what it feels like to play them. Not necessarily to own them, but we do need to go and do a guitar shop visit, mate. Let's get that organised.
We'll get out there in the next few weeks and just go and purely try some ridiculously expensive instruments and see how many of them float our boat. My hypothesis is we will be equally amazed and disappointed.
Yeah.
And that will vary from guitar to guitar in that price range is my experience. You try some in that kind of $6,000-$7,000 range. Even $3,000-$4,000, and some of them you just go, yeah, I can totally see why they're charging this. This is just a dream machine. And some of them you go, they're charging how much for this? This, it's not worth it. It's not great. So,
yeah, let's do it. All right, dude. Great conversation today, mate. I absolutely love kind of pulling this apart. I think it's a really, and to anyone who's listening, please head over to our page on Facebook, the Guitar Geek Hangout. Come and join the page and let's talk about this, because I really want to know what people think. I know there's going to be a lot of listeners that own some highly coveted instruments that they absolutely love and spent a lot of money on, and you're going to want to have your say, and likewise some people who've got a love for cheaper instruments like we have, and you're going to want to have your say as well. Come and tell us what you think. Come and get involved in the conversation, and we can carry on this chat another time. I think that'd be really cool.
Great plan, mate. Sounds good. Well, have a great gig tomorrow night.
Yeah, you too, mate.
And
you
too. Look forward to hearing how the Catalyst performed.
Yeah, I'll let you know next week. I'm sure it'll all be
astounding.
Absolutely fantastic. Can't wait to give it a go.
Yeah. All right, buddy. I'll speak to you again next week.
All the best, buddy. I'll speak to you soon. Ta-da, mate. Thanks so much for listening. If you like what you hear, then remember there are 74 other episodes going back over 2 years that you can check out, where we talk about all kinds of things like the best budget guitar amps, a visit to the London Guitar Show, Desert Island gear and rigs and music, Murphy Lab guitars, loads of stuff. Anyway, go and enjoy them, and we'll see you next time on the Guitar Smarts Podcast.